welcome to the Decipher podcast. My friend Andy Ellis is back with me. Andy is the chief security officer at Akamai. He's been on this podcast a few times. I think the most recent time was not too long after the quarantine started, Andy. I looked it up. I think it was in late April, early May when I had you on, which seems like 15 years ago now.
Seems simultaneous. It's like 15 years ago or yesterday. I can't tell which one.
Just because a lot has changed and almost nothing has changed, like just in that time frame, almost a year. And I think the podcast that we did last year, most of what we were talking about at the time was kind of how you were thinking about how to respond to the pandemic itself, both, you know, physical safety considerations, as well as how it kind of influenced your thinking about security. Or you're thinking about security influenced your preparedness for the pandemic. And looking back on that, you know, with almost a year's kind of perspective, how if at all, has your thinking in that regard changed?
Well, definitely, I think I underestimated how long we were going to be in this state. Like, I think that when we all went into the pandemic, we were like, oh yeah, 3 weeks to flatten the curve.
Remember that phrase?
Yeah. Remember that phrase? Yeah. Flatten the curve. And it's interesting because it's very similar to, I think, what we see in a lot of security projects. That you're like, oh, like here's this big project. We just need to rally everybody around behind it and we'll be done. Except it turns out you're not done. It's going to drag on for a long time. And it feels like the goalposts move. And often it does. You know, when you're doing anything like this, any risk mitigation project, one of the things you need to do is be honest with yourself about what are the success criteria. What will allow you to declare success, even if it's just for one phase of it? You know, we've accomplished the mission of flattening the curve. We never declared success on that, but we succeeded. Like, we got to a state where medical professionals understood how to do treatments that weren't actively harmful. You know, that did take us a little while. I think we don't really recognize that what we were buying was time for every medical professional on the planet to learn what this thing was. And we didn't want a big spike that would totally overwhelm them. Now, yes, are we seeing ramp ups? But imagine if we had this level of infection, what we're seeing today, that feels normal now. But what if that had hit us in April? Like, how many more people would have been dead? So we succeeded. We flattened the curve, but we forgot to declare success because now, oh, we got to do this next big thing. Everybody's got to wear a mask. We got to shut down the schools. We got to keep the schools shut down. No parties, nothing above 10 people. And now everybody get vaccinated. Oh, but it turns out maybe after you're vaccinated, you know, you got to wait a while because we don't know how long it takes to develop immunity. You know, the data out of Israel is sort of mixed at this point.
Yeah, I've seen some... like everybody else, I've seen a ton of mixed messages on the vaccination part of it. You know, the thing you just mentioned about Israel, I read that, and I've spoken to some of my friends who are in the medical profession. They've been vaccinated, a couple of whom have already gotten the second dose of the vaccine, and they're not totally sure. They're just kind of like, you know, we're the first wave, so we're kind of the ones that are going to figure it out for you.
Right, because we don't have the data. Normally, you would do like 5 years of clinical trials, and we'd have like really strong data that would say, look, you get your shot, and here's the growth of your immunity over, you know, the next 6 months, and then you get your second shot, and here's what it looks like, and we would understand that. But the reality is we did one clinical trial functionally, so we have data that says, well, if you do the shots this close together, it looks like it works. And that's it. So we're going to learn from it. This isn't me arguing that we should have done longer clinical trials. In this case, we did the right thing. We raced it out. Let's get it out at warp speed. But yeah, now we've got to figure out what this really means. And it's not binary. And that's the biggest challenge for risk management is people really want to get to a yes or no decision. Like, is it safe to do this or is it not safe to do this? And that's really a challenge because that's people who are thinking like it's a chess game. Where in theory, you could know all of the moves possible and know what's the right way to structure it. Instead, it's a lot like playing poker. And look, I'm stealing that analogy from Annie Duke. I've been reading her book, Thinking in Bets. I could pick it up for you, but none of the podcasters could, people listening on the podcast would see it. And it's a really great point. Like, we have to make decisions based on incomplete information where we can't predict the future. We don't know what's going to happen. And sometimes they don't turn out well. And sometimes they do. And so we just have to make our best choices. And people want it to be very binary. It's like there's a good choice and there's a bad choice, rather than, look, there are two really bad choices in front of us. Either race the vaccine or stall the vaccine to get really good data. Like, both of those are actually risky choices. We picked the one that we thought had the better payoff.
And the risks are different for almost everyone, because right, people have different underlying conditions. They have different risk factors that, you know, don't involve the vaccine itself. They may have environmental factors. They may have familial factors, that kind of stuff. And, you know, which in a lot of ways kind of reminds me of a lot of the conversations that we have about security. There's not a binary state where you're secure or you're not secure. You can certainly be far less secure or more secure, but there's no end state where everything is cool. Like, you know, if we want to maybe tie it to, you know, the most recent big story, the SolarWinds thing, look at some of the companies that have been affected by this. These are companies that we often hold up as knowing what they're doing. Like, Microsoft knows what it's doing. Right. FireEye knows what it's doing, you know, and they got hit. Right. So this is the thing that we, you know, tell people all the time. Like, you can be doing the right things all the time, but there's good people on the other side of the ball too, or talented, not good.
Yeah. Well, and the reality is, you take risk to do anything. If you're not willing to take any risk, get out of business. Like, the only way to have no risk is to not make any progress. So you look at it and people are like, oh, well, maybe they shouldn't have bought SolarWinds. Like, well, how much more money would they have to spend to have done that themselves? And that's not actually saying it would be better. Look, I've been on the soapbox, I think, by myself for a very long time, that says admin privileges at the domain level are a bad idea. That we have to figure out how to get to a world where individual computers and servers are not administered centrally with root access. Like, it's one thing to push a config out, but this idea that, like, some admin in the company can, you know, install a piece of software on my machine in an automated fashion means that there's an entire logistics pipeline that gives you root access on my machine.
Right.
Instead of it being, look, I've got a machine, it's out of the box, I'm getting vendor updates that continuously come in, and I've got a small client that sits autonomously and locks this machine down and reports status out so that IT knows it's in a great state. Like, that's a better place you almost want to head towards, where each machine, you know, is self-configuring. And I think we're closer to that. If we look today, you know, I would take, you know, a Windows or Mac machine today over the best machine administered 10 years ago. Oh, like, sure. Just out of the box, like, from the vendor, install everything on it that the vendor recommends. I think you're in a better shape today than you would have been 10 years ago in the best protected enterprise.
Yeah, I think that's right. I recently had to set up a new laptop for one of my in-laws, and, like, you know, my father-in-law, he's like, oh, I've got this Windows laptop. It was probably a dozen years old or something. He's like, you know, it's starting to make these grinding noises like a blender. I was like, yeah, that thing's got to go. And so he's like, well, I went to Best Buy and looked at all these. I'm like, no, hang on. No, we're getting you a Chromebook, and it's going to be this, and you're not going to have to worry about patching. You're not going to have to worry about, you know, all this kind of stuff. And I set it up in 5 minutes, and, you know, no tech support calls later. Selfishly, that was my vote. Oh,
that was my, I moved my family, everybody over to Macs probably 12 years ago for that reason. I moved and I said, sorry, if you're on a Windows machine, I won't take any tech support calls. Right. And so they said, oh, well, we'll move to Mac so we get tech support. And in those days, Macs didn't really need much tech support. So the tech support went to zero. You know, today I might do the same thing with Chromebooks. Say, well, let's just move to Chromebooks.
Yeah. How do your kids' school have the same, my kids' school, like, if they have any work in the olden times that they did at school, it was on Chromebooks.
Yeah. So for my kids, they can do Chromebook or Macs. Both of them are supported. The school allows you to. The answer is you support your own.
Okay.
But they do everything they're doing is Google Classroom and Google Drive. Yeah. So, and it was that way before. Now it's just shifted to everything is turned in electronically. know, before, right. like you do your math homework and you'd hand it in. Now you do it and then you take a picture of it. And it was funny because my son really likes to play with the various programs that'll let him like you'd write in his answers and draw his graphs. And yeah. one of his math teachers is like, no, no, I want to see you draw this by hand. I want to see that you understand how to draw the curve, which is really fair when you think about it. But he was very grumpy. Yeah. He's like, but I could just like go into, you know, whichever app and put in the function and it draws the curve for me. I'm it's like, yeah.
It's the equivalent of having to walk up in front of class and draw it on the chalkboard. Like we exactly. all did when we were kids, you know, which sucked. But yeah. They're getting past that now.
No, but what I love is my daughter started high school this year, and like I just get to see all of her assignment grades in real time. Like yeah. as soon as a grade gets entered, I get to see it, and it's been really helpful because she was very frustrated. You know, one of her classes, she didn't get the A that she was expecting. She was right on that border between like A minus and B plus, and she was very upset with it. And I said, okay, I pulled up and I said, show me these assignments. Like, I'm looking at the ones that brought your grade down. Let me see what you did. And I walked through them and I read the rubric and I'm like, oh, I understand exactly why you got this grade. And we walked through and she's like, oh, I really wish I'd done this. And I said, well, next semester, when you're struggling if you struggle in a class like this, come talk to me.
Yeah. And I can, I can do
it. It was nice that I had one class I could do that. She's a ninth grader who just got an A in AP Calculus BC. In which she needed basically no help all semester from me. She did it in one semester.
Wow. Like,
I'm not very necessary there on the math side.
Damn. Yeah, no, that's a ninth grade is right around the time that my daughter, she's a freshman in college now, but like ninth grade math is right around when she stopped like even considering asking me for like, you know, yeah. eighth grade, I kind of could help with the algebra, but like once she got to like pre-calc and like, you know, all that kind of stuff, I was like, hey, call grandpa. He, you know, he's got you.
I was happy to help. Like I was a math minor and, you know, all of her, you know, her grandparents on my wife's side, Giselle's side, are both, you know, math professors. We were like all set to help her. She needs no help.
Oh, well, that's even better.
Yeah.
That's great. That's, I mean, you've done your job.
We did our job.
That's great. She's only in ninth grade. I was thinking about the thing that you said earlier, Andy, where you were like, you know, at the beginning of the quarantine and the pandemic, we were all saying, you know, flatten the curve and then we'll get to this date and then we'll get to the next step and the next step. And it was reminding me of the emails that I've been getting from my daughter's college this whole time where, you know, she was supposed to go on campus last August. That didn't happen. But almost right up until it was too late to say, don't come, they were still saying, oh, here's your room assignment. Here's your move-in day, all that kind of stuff. And then, you know, 24 hours later, they're like, everything's terrible. Nobody can come. And it's just like, there clearly was not the kind of risk assessment and long-term thinking going along with that that you would have liked to see. It was more about, we really want that room and board revenue.
Right.
You know,
not even the room and board, the tuition. Like how many schools, if they had told you early in the summer, if they had said, yeah, we're not going to be in person, how many people would have said, well, I'm not paying your tuition for a virtual class. Like, I'll send my kid to a community college virtually. Like, that's just as good. Or heck, like, I'll hire some other out of school student and have them be a tutor and do like the MITx program. Like, MIT's classes are all already online. So are Harvard's. Like your kid could have taken a year at MIT or Harvard, just not been graded by the actual professor. Like I think a lot of schools were just worried. And I think we see that in business as well, that somebody has a breach and a big piece of their mental calculus isn't the long-term viability of their business. It's how do we make sure we just don't lose revenue next quarter? Like how do we keep the existing customers? And so maybe you have companies that slow roll notification of their breach. They're going to downplay the effects of the breach. They're going to sort of stretch it out as long as they can. Like, what can I do to keep you? Because they're not really thinking about what is best for their customer. They're dealing with their own bottom line at that point.
Right. Yeah. And I've seen that for, you know, 15 years, 20 years. As soon as we started having some form of mandatory breach notification, that I think the California law was the first one that really had a big effect, you would see these very small kind of like point notifications. Like right. some customers in California were affected, and then, you know, a week later, oh, it turns out some other state's customers were affected, and then it turns out to be like 40 million people.
Right.
Like,
but it turned out it was really easy to say, well, we have to notify because of California. So let's notify as fast as we can before we know how bad this is.
Yeah.
So that the initial reporting covers, oh yeah, minor data breach, just affected some people in California. They don't think any personally identifiable information was actually leaked. And then, you know, 2 months later, it turns out, no, the whole database was gone.
Right. Those are the stories that end up getting drawn out over weeks or months, are the ones where the, you know, the victim organization itself kind of strings out the yep. information like you just described. It's the same way as like, you know, a scandal with like an athlete or something like that, where it's like, just, you know, cut the guy. Like, don't just be like, oh, we're investigating, we're not really sure what he did, you know, last night at the club. We'll let you all know when we figure it out. Just, you know, you want to get it done, right?
Like, right.
Tear the Band-Aid off. Like, get it all out of the way.
Yeah, no, it's you want that, but at the same time, it turns out that, look, if I tell you that we have a small problem, and then I tell you we have a medium problem, and then I tell you we have a large problem, your brain can deal with that better. You never enter crisis mode. If you go from no problem to large problem, now you're in crisis mode, you will react differently.
That's a good point. I guess, from
a PR perspective, I think, and I'm not the PR professional here, but I think the downplaying it as much as you can early to get a multiple waves of notification, if it's going to be really bad. If it's not going to be really bad, I think you want to just like bite the medium pill. But if it's a large pill, I would chop that thing right up.
I know some of your PR people. I'm sure they're going to enjoy this. So a couple of topics I wanted to hit with you that are pretty timely. We're actually recording this about an hour and a half after the inauguration,
yep.
Which is just kind of a coincidence, but I think it's fortuitous, because there's a couple of things I wanted to hit with you. One was kind of in terms of priorities. So you as a CSO of a very large company that has customers all across the world, if you're doing your priority planning, say for a new year or fiscal year or quarter, how do you even begin that process? You know, I'm thinking about the way that the Biden administration has to, you know, think about lots of things, but cybersecurity our area of interest right here. There's a lot of things to address for that administration right now, and it's probably not unlike the way that you would have to approach it for your organization.
Yep. I think there's a difference in when you're running the same organization. I think this idea of annual priorities is kind of a myth, right? You're running multi-year priorities. But we're at this point where it's a new organization and a new boss showing up. So they get this opportunity to say, hey, some things will be current course and speed, but we're going to make changes that otherwise would be really hard to make. It's like, imagine if like you and I have been doing this for a long time and I say, look, Dennis, today is the day that I need you to upgrade your microphone. And you're going to be like, 4 years we've been doing podcasts and today you want me to do it? Like, what's going on? But if it was a new person and they said it, you'd be like, oh, their priority is high-end microphones. I totally get it. Same thing with security, right? You can come in and where you have that, you know, the 100-day window, I think is real. That before organizational stasis sets in, you have an opportunity to really do two things and they're related. One is you could just get some successes in. Right? And the reason for those successes, it's not about big changes that are going to alter the course of history. You know, if you could do it in 100 days and alter the course of history, more power to you. But what you're really doing is altering the mindset of your entire bureaucracy. They see that you get things done, that when you say something's going to happen, you mean it. And so now when you say the second thing that's going to take a year, they don't just say, oh yeah, you know, same thing is all, every year. You know, when I was in the Air Force, we had this happen. I came into a new assignment. I showed up and weird, I was a first lieutenant and everybody who worked for me was a civilian. I didn't actually have any military staff. I had civilian staff out of a contractor and they were permanent location staff. Like, I didn't get to hire or fire them. They didn't really work for me. They were just assigned to me. And one of them straight out said, she said, look, this is the way I do this job. within 3 years, you won't be here anymore, but I will be. I will still be doing this job this way. Mm-hmm. Right. So there was, she basically just started out by saying, you know, I've been through enough officers who've come through here who think they know what they're doing. And that's the same thing the Biden administration is going to be facing. Right. We didn't just turn over everybody in the government. Right. Same people have been there doing their day jobs. What they need to hear is meaningful action on things, and they can see the successes.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm always optimistic. My attitude about Inauguration Day has been my entire life. I always hope that the person who gets inaugurated, you know, and I'm very excited that maybe someday soon it won't be man, but it's all just preemptively say the person who gets inaugurated will step up into the role that they're taking. You know, and let's be honest, that has not always been the case. You know, with lots of presidents who have failed to meet that standard. But this is the opportunity where they can step up and they can lead and say, let's set the priorities. What can we do that will make a difference? And it'll make a difference in 100 days so that people see that we're serious. We have a success, and now we can move on to whatever that next success is.
How big of a part of that, in both in your organization and something like the federal government, is having the right people in place to actually implement the things that you want to get done?
It is significant. I don't think it can be understated, but it's about having the right people in the right places. And so when you look across the government, which is just an enterprise writ large,
yeah,
right? People try to say, well, you need to have the right CISO in every place in the government. And the reality is, if no place is doing it well, then you don't want to try to solve it everywhere at once. You want to say, how do I get a small team? It's one of the reasons I'm a big fan of the U.S. Digital Service, right? They're this example of getting a bunch of really right people in a small place and go fix problems so that other people see that fixes are possible. And then the right people in other locations can build off of that success. In the same thing, when you're building a small security team, or a large one, you know, I have 90 people that work for me. You know, we have people whose job is like, just see a problem and go fix it. Like, don't even ask permission. Just go try something. And if it fails, great, you learned something. Tell us what not to do next time. And if it succeeds, we can use that success as a reference for other projects. But we don't try to fix everything at once in the same way. Now, other times you take something where you know what the right solution is, and you just tell everybody to go fix it. And this is always a fun one when you're like, look, I got 40 vice presidents that I'm telling them all that they need to do this thing. And all of them will say the same thing. They're like, well, what's the priority, relative priority among all of us? Like, who needs to be first? And my answer is, no, you don't get an answer that says you're not first. All of you need to be first. And I'm going to rely on all of you getting it done. And sure, I really expect 60% will do it without me coming back to you. But I don't need to figure out who the 40% are that will be the slowest that need that extra assistance. Show me who that is by getting the work done. Like, do it in parallel. Very similar to actually the vaccination strategies that we've seen people propose, right? There's sort of two strategies, which is priority and shots in arm. Right. And so yeah. One says, make sure that you do them in priority, that you understand that, like, Dennis Fisher is at the bottom of the totem pole. He gets his shot last. And so don't ever give it to him until it's his turn in line. Whereas the other strategy says, we have only so much vaccine. Our limit is how many vaccine shots we have. So make sure they all get into an arm. And literally, like, you get these stories out of places. Israel's full of them, where at the end of a day, just go walk past a clinic and there's a good chance you get a vaccine. Because yeah. They'll walk out on the street and they're like, we have 7 extra shots. Who wants them? And it's like shot in arm, like, just get that vaccine out there. And yes, at the end, we're going to have to do some cleanup to figure out, okay, who did we miss? Let's make sure they get in, because we didn't have this perfect ordered list. But the perfect ordered lists never work anyway.
No, it's very true. And I'm glad you mentioned the digital service. I wonder, it's a super interesting group that is not very old, and I don't think it's all that well known outside of, like, the DC. And certainly the security community knows about it pretty well, because there's a lot of folks that have been in private enterprise that have worked yep. in the digital service over the years. It's a cool concept of a small group that moves fast and does stuff, you know, just gets things done.
Yep.
I've spoken to a few of those people over the years, and they're like, you know, a lot of times, you know, the federal government is a place where you have to ask permission, and it's a top-down organization like the military, but we've kind of been able to get around that, you know, in some cases. Like, we can do that, like they the bug bounty programs that hacked the Pentagon thing that, you know, that was set up a few years ago served as a template for other programs and other agencies around the federal government. Have you been able, or have you seen large enterprises that have been able to replicate this, like kind of a small Skunk Works type team like that to, you know, to move fast and get things done?
So I think we see that in a lot of places, and it has different shapes. There's not, this is the way to do it if you're going to do it. Like we have a labs team that will experiment on things like that. And they've built internal video conferencing that we ended up shelving. It was a cool thing when nobody had good video conferencing, and now there's a bunch of commercial video conferencing. So why did we maintain our own? In my organization, we've done that. In fact, one of the more interesting sort of career successes is just this last year, literally in December, we introduced the first ever IT-supported vacation tracking tool globally. Like we'd had one just for some places. Up until then, for the prior 17 years, it had been built and run by my team. Because 17 years ago, we needed one, we built one, because we could run it on top of our GRC system, which gave us really interesting things that like no other company has. When we would send you email to remind you to come to your annual security awareness testing, check it off, it would notice if you were on vacation and not send you in mail. But say, oh, let's not send him mail today. He's on vacation. We'll wait until next Monday. Like, why bother filling up your inbox? Like one little thing, an integration step that basically almost nobody else has. But we said, hey, we could just build it. And so some companies do it that way. We have a decentralized, like different teams might move fast to break things. Sometimes you build your own Skunk Works. The hardest part is transition. How do you let that team transition what they built into a supportable fashion in a way that works and doesn't leave them sort of carrying the weight of whatever they just built? That's the place I see most companies have struggle with.
That's a good point. The other thing, I'm sure you've seen this too, is sometimes you'll get a little bit of organizational jealousy from the teams that don't get to do that kind of stuff. And they're like, well, wait, why do I have to sit through 27 meetings to get something done? And these guys just get to do whatever they want.
Right. You know, yeah. And it can be a challenge. And especially if you look at like, what are the projects for which this makes sense? Right. Yeah. If you have to sit through 27 meetings because we're saying for anything that touches on life safety, like that's what you need to go through, then you have to make sure that a life safety change isn't going through the Skunk Works program, right? That the Skunk Works is really for things that for which it really does make sense, right? Or they just get, maybe it's you're saying, look, they just get top priority. They're also sitting through 27 meetings. They just get to force everybody to show up at once and do them at the same time. Like we're having a 27-person meeting to have our 27 meetings. Whereas, look, yes, you are currently in the less important group, but let's figure out how to make you get their benefits, right? I think that's an under-discussed benefit, is that it shows how sclerotic some bureaucracies are.
Yeah,
and gives you an opportunity to say, hey, maybe our processes are slow for reasons that don't matter. And if it takes us 4 months to have one meeting because it's across 27 people, and so we don't make any progress and we're not getting any value out of waiting 4 months, that's an opportunity to remove the bureaucracy steps and streamline them into a way that will make more sense.
And that goes back to the thing you mentioned earlier with, you know, you walking into a job where you were, you know, a military boss of civilian employees, and they're like, well, this is the way that we do it. And you're like, well, you know, the answer that this is the way we've always done it is never going to be a good answer to me. You know, like, well, why have you always done it that way? Does that work? What's the outcome? Right.
And their answer was, it works for us and we're tired of switching every 3 years.
And I'm retiring in 7 years and I don't need your shit.
Yeah, so. there's a really great anecdote. I don't know if you've read Patrick Rothfuss, The Name of the Wind.
No.
But it's but buried in there, there's this fantastic little anecdote about they have this library where all of the texts are stored. sort of, you know, going back for to whenever. Okay. And if it's like the art, it's the Arcanum, like this is the one university, it's where they teach magic. And the texts are so old, they don't know where they all are. And every so often, the archivist, whoever's the new master archivist, says, you know, I don't like the schema that's being used for only half of the library. So they create a new schema. And now, like, all of their assistants spend their entire lifetime trying to reorganize the library. Except they never finish. And so the library ends up with like 17 different organizational systems. And they talk about at one point there was like a civil war between like, you know, half of them doing it one way and half doing it another way. But imagine if you're that, you know, civilian employee and you're like, look, I have a system that works. And every 3 years, somebody who won't bear the consequences of failure is going to come in and try to rewrite it. It's actually not unreasonable for them to say, I'm not interested in proving to you that this system works. As the person on the other side of it, I wasn't happy. And at the time, I thought they were the problem. And now I at least understand why they were behaving that way.
Yeah, there are good reasons for some of that stuff, as you just described. They're just, people don't always articulate them.
Right. They weren't even interested in articulating, just to be clear. Like, they didn't say, oh, here's why we do it and this is a good approach. They were like, we don't want your input, because if we get into the habit of letting you give input, then every 3 years we will get a new set of input.
Ah, that's a good point too. Yeah.
Right. The next lieutenant who shows up will think they're clever. And of course, none of them would have been as clever as I was, but how does the civilian know that?
They wouldn't. They didn't know your reputation at the time. They didn't know you had handed out Goofy's costume at Disney.
That's right.
Disneyland, pardon me. Yeah, they didn't know your background. All right, now that we got the serious stuff out of the way, I wanted to talk to you in the same vein as priorities. We root for two separate football teams.
They both of which have six Super Bowl trophies.
That's correct. And they both have a lot of blank spots on their rosters, I would say, right now. Maybe mine more than yours, oddly.
No, we've got a lot that you just didn't see because everybody saw the one big blank spot.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Yeah, plus you guys had a lot of folks that opted out.
Yeah.
And things like that. You don't know where they're going to go. So if you're, I don't even know, who's the Pats general manager right now? I have no idea.
Bill Belichick.
Of course it is. Yeah. God himself is the general manager.
I'm blanking on the name. It starts with a Z, the guy who's going to step up to fill Nick Caserio's spot. It had been Monty Osifort, but he got a job last year. So Dave Ziegler, maybe something like that.
But Belichick is probably the one actually.
Belichick's the one who makes the choices.
Right. Makes the trade down every time to get six more third round picks. If you're prioritizing things for your guy over there in Foxborough, not too far from you, where are you spending your draft capital this year?
So I think it's a lot depends on it's the best available player. Like, that's been the Patriots motto for a long time. It's like, who's the best available player when they're picking? Now, obviously they need a quarterback, but what we've really seen in the NFL is quarterback is hit or miss. Like, you're rolling a die every time somebody drafts a quarterback. Maybe you get Carson Wentz, who was fantastic for a couple of years and then a disaster last year. Maybe he'll be back. Maybe you get Josh Allen, who was a disaster for 3 years and is now leading the Bills to a Super Bowl. Like, there's a good chance that by the time this airs, we're going to be like, oh my God, the Bills finally won a Super Bowl. Or what I'm hoping for is, the Bills just lost to Tom Brady again.
In some just mind-crushing manner.
So, you know, you just don't know. But obviously, you got to look at the quarterbacks available. Either trade up, you know, if that's an option, or get whoever falls to you. I think they have like the 15th pick. And there are some people who are projecting, you know, one of the good quarterbacks might be available just based on who's picking where and what they might need. And there's a lot of quarterbacks that are going to be traded around in the next few months. You know, Deshaun Watson, who knows what's going to happen there.
I'd take him.
Absolutely, in a heartbeat.
Please.
So I think the way that you look at building a team that's important is when you have a hole on your team, somebody leaves for whatever reason, you don't try to replace them, right? Not them exactly, because everybody is unclonable, right? The Patriots are not getting another Tom Brady. We'd love it. I'd be ecstatic if they could draft somebody, the 199th pick, and they turned out to be another 20-year franchise quarterback. Yeah. But I'm not really holding out hope for that. What you do is you find great people who bring something to your team, and you put them in spots to succeed, and you build a gestalt that covers all of your holes. And look, the Patriots were in the hole this year because they spent a ton of money for the last 5 years. They were in salary cap disaster at the start of the season. They literally had, it was under $100,000 at one point in salary cap space. Like, if it hadn't, but then we had 8 opt-outs. So all of a sudden they had a ton of money. But by the time they had that money, there weren't really any free agents that you could spend big money on. And you couldn't train them. They couldn't come in and learn to work with your team because of the COVID protocols.
Right.
But now they're walking in with some ungodly amount. I think it's like $50 million in cap space.
Yeah, it's
going into 2021, the exact opposite of the Saints, who like are over by like $95 million or something crazy.
Even if Breeze retires, they're in
touch. Right, like Breeze retiring doesn't solve their problem by a long shot. It's not clear the Saints can field any player whose name you will remember at the start of the season. Like, everybody whose name is known, I think probably is going to have to go. And that's an important thing, is you have to recognize that you can't build a team out of superstars, right? We're all budget constrained. We don't have a salary cap in industry, but functionally we do. I've got a budget. I can't hire 90 people who are chief security officers who've worked their way up. In a sense, what you really have to do is something like the Moneyball approach. Right. We look at, you know, what happened when, you know, there's like, oh my goodness, we're getting rid of these amazing players, but can we replace pieces of what they do by bringing in people who are undervalued by the market?
Right.
And maybe they're undervalued simply because they're more junior in their career and we can develop them. Let's take you, for example. I'm going to put you on the spot for a moment, Dennis.
Sure.
Same thing I do with my team. Like, both, you know, Akamai and Duo said, hey, we want to have arms of our business that are telling security stories. Now, the way in which many companies would have approached that would have been to say, hey, let's get a senior security person and let's teach that security person how to tell stories.
Right.
What did we do? We said, wait a second, there's an entire industry over there that knows how to tell stories, that has people who've learned to tell security stories very well. Let's hire them to do their job. And they do it very well. So we have journalists that we've hired in to both companies that, I mean, no offense, but like, you're cheaper than if we'd said, oh, let's get like the single best security talent and then teach them how to do podcasting and write reporting. And it wouldn't have been as good as yours. Like, that's the thing that I always find funny, is people look for this amazing singular talent who can do everything. And I'm like, first of all, you have to pay them an arm and a leg if they're singular. And they're probably not better at 90% of the work than somebody that's their specialty. Yeah, so let's get somebody to specialize in that and do that job, and learn how to teach them. Because frankly, like, you create better replaceability in your organization by having people who fill roles that you don't over-rely on them. And if I had to pick a failing of the Patriots, is we over-relied on Tom Brady. Now, 6 Super Bowls later, I'm not going to complain too much about that over-reliance. But he left and it became very clear, like, oh, how much did he allow you to have, you know, great wide receivers, but not the best talent?
Yeah, and I think obviously they did that with a purpose in mind. I mean, there have been stories that came out in the last year or so where they said, you know, Belichick telling Brady essentially, like, listen, we're going for broke for these next couple of years.
Yeah.
And then, you know, we'll see what happens. But that's what he was 40 or 39 or whatever at the time. You know, he's 42 now. Like, there's only so much time left, even for Tom Brady.
Right. And Brady says he wants to play to 45, and the Patriots didn't actually plan for him to pull that off.
Yeah,
and literally, they couldn't have re-signed him this year. There wasn't the money to do so. They knew there wasn't going to be the money, so they gave him a graceful exit. And sure, Brady probably is also motivated by Brady has 6 rings and Belichick has 8. I think we would be foolish not to think that part of why Brady left is to see if he could catch Belichick.
Oh, yeah. But Belichick has a boat, which he renames every time he wins a new Super Bowl. It's 8 rings. It's not 6.
It's not 6. It's 8.
People forget about those two with the Giants, but Belichick doesn't. And I think you're 100% right that Brady doesn't either. There's no way
Brady doesn't know that. Because now, Brady is tied with the Crafts as well. Right? So the Crafts have 6. So the Patriot organization has 6. The Steelers organization has 6. Tom Brady has 6. That's it. So if Brady can win one, he becomes 7 behind Belichick's 8. And I think that, like, moving out of the tie for second place, holding it alone, and then aiming for that first place, you know that's in his drive.
Yeah. And we were talking about this before we started recording, actually, whether the injury that Brady suffered, I think it was in 07, the 08. Beginning of the 08 season.
Yeah, 07 was the other season we don't like to talk about sometimes.
Right. But it was like 10 minutes into the season. You know, he tears his ACL. He's out for the year. And as you said, that probably set him on this, or did set him on this, you know, path of healthy living. I'm never having another cheeseburger. I'm eating avocado ice cream, all that shit that everybody likes to make fun of him.
Pliability.
For. Yeah, pliability, baby. And coffee table books. But had that not happened, I think he ends up with, you know, maybe he wins another Super Bowl or two or whatever. Yep. He had 3 at the time that happened, but he's not still playing, I don't think.
No, I think he'd be out. I don't know that he would have made it to 2018. Yeah. Honestly, I look at now and I say, okay, he came into the league in, was it 99 or 2000? I never remember which year he was drafted. I think 2000. Because Manning came in 99. He came in 2000. And so if you say, oh, look, he would have a career, you know, all the 2004 quarterbacks are retiring this year. So go back 4 years, say, oh, Brady maybe retires in 2016. So maybe that's his last Super Bowl win. But would he have been the guy we saw on the field in 2016? Who was, you know, a legend? Like, that 2016 Brady was better than any of the 2004 quarterbacks we're seeing playing right now.
I can attest to that. Yes. And to, you know, stretch the analogy a little further, I think there's something to be said for in the same way that happened for Brady and set him on this path, organizations that suffer some sort of, you know, traumatic security incident. You know, we can look at Google with Aurora back in 2009 or 10, whatever year that was. Mm-hmm. That, I mean, they were already a pretty mature security organization, but look where they are now. Lots of other organizations, you know, Microsoft back in the day, there's probably some scar tissue and resilience that builds up from that, that if you don't suffer those, you don't figure out the weak spots that you have.
Right. I think it helps you prioritize. It makes a risk real for you. And so you say, look, I'm going to go and I'm going to do this thing now. Like, I see behind you, I see what, you know, your Peloton. So I think that's a Peloton there. And I got one sitting around the corner here. But why am I on that bike every day? Because a year and a half ago, my doctor looked at me and he's looked at my weight and he looked at my cholesterol. And he said, you know, I'm your coach. And the job of a coach is to put you in the right place to succeed. And he used a football analogy that I'll spare some folks here, the memories of that, of a specific Super Bowl and a player in the right place. And he said, and if you want to be in the place where you're at your kid's wedding, you have to make a change. Right. And there's this moment. And thankfully I didn't have like, oh my God, something horrible happened to my health, but it was this moment of awareness that shifts your priorities. Right. And so that setback can be a data breach. It can be you really just believe you see it happen to somebody else. And so you're willing to recognize. It can be somebody who you trust comes in and tells you, hey, you have just got to pay attention to this because your eye's on the wrong thing. But as long as you have that awareness shift, your mental model changes. And now you're going to say, the way I was before is not how I'm going to be going forward. But it has to be accompanied by successes. Like, you get under the bike and you get the little high fives from people saying, hey, you're doing great. You get the little milestone. Like, you have completed your first ride. And you're like, oh, this is going to be awesome. don't know if you got a shout out on your first ride on the bike. I did. So I'm like, I get shouted out by the instructors whenever I'm on the bike. It's like, no. Long time. It's like
once every 6 months. Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, you're right. And I think about that all the time when I see in our industry people, you know, a CISO who was at an organization that got breached and then they moved somewhere else. And people are like, oh, well, why would you hire that person? They, you know, they were at, you know, organization XYZ when they got hit. I'm like, that's exactly why you might want to hire them. They've got some experience under their belt. They didn't get that CISO job because they were dumb. You know, people make mistakes and they learn from them, hopefully.
Yeah.
And you, somebody that's been through something like that, you might want that life experience.
You want that experience. You recognize that, look, they made gambles. You also need to recognize that they're not the only decision maker. Like when a company suffers a breach, you know, I often joke that CSO stands for Chief Scapegoat Officer. Of course the CSO is going to lose their job. But do any of us actually think that the CSO is the only decision maker in a company? Right? It's a whole executive team is making decisions. Now the CSO has a role to play and it might be their failure, but from the outside, we can't really tell what the dynamics were.
Yeah. And I mean, the CSO can't keep people from clicking on phishing links. I mean, you can train them to look for them and train them to avoid them. And
or you can deploy technology that makes phishing links not matter.
Yeah. 2FA helps kids.
Yeah. The reality is, like, when you start in a new company, what's the first thing you do? You click on links so you can get paid. Like, we have established a very clear protocol that if you would like to be employed by this company, you will click on links.
Yeah.
Yep. So you'd better make it that those links don't hurt you, not that you're relying on somebody noticing a link and saying, oh, that's not the right one. Because their mail client makes it easy. Mail clients contribute to the phishing problem. Like, oh, I can send you mail that, you know, claims to be from, you know, Ben Roethlisberger, and it'll look like Ben Roethlisberger, and you'll be like, oh, this is awesome. Actually, knowing you, you'd be like, just delete it. Go away, Ben.
I'm not opening that
email. Not opening that one.
You've hurt me too many times, Ben. Get out of my life. I'm not falling for your
crap. Yeah, but I'm all about the Tom Brady mail. Like, you know, send me something from TB12 Sports. I'm right there.
All right. So if we're speaking a few months from now after the draft.
Yep.
Best case scenario for you. Not necessarily the player, but what positions would you like to see fortified? Obviously, you need a QB, whether it's through the draft or free agency or trade or whatever. Definitely need some other skill players.
So I've got to look and see what we lose in free agency.
Yeah.
Like offensive line and defensive line right there. Those are my two most important places. If you don't have an offensive line, you don't have an offense. Mm-hmm. I think people really underrate the five guys who start. And it's really the seven or eight guys that are your game day offensive line. That those players really matter. The Patriots have been blessed. We've had a great offensive line. But, you know, Joe Tooney is coming off a franchise tag year. David Andrews is in a contract year. Like, these guys are phenomenal, and you got to replace them. Yeah. That's my top. Defensive line, because if you can't hold a front with two or three guys in the modern NFL, you're out of luck, because then you're pulling somebody out of the secondary.
Yeah.
I'm looking at the linebacking core. Yeah, I think they've got a good young core here. Not as much leadership as I want, but Dante Hightower is hopefully coming back for another year to provide a bunch of that. But they just lost a lot of guys in free agency over the last couple of years.
Right.
I'm not worried about the secondary. Like, I think we probably have one of the best secondaries in the NFL. And
that's probably their strongest unit right now.
It really is. A lot of folks are questioning whether Stephon Gilmore will play the last year on his contract, because he got a big bonus. They front loaded him with a signing bonus. So his actual, you know, game day check is like $7 million for the year, which is undervalued, but there's another like $7 million in salary cap on deferred bonus for him. Yikes. So we'll see. But the Gilmore Jackson pairing is an amazing 1-2. Like, I don't think JC Jackson is really a number one cornerback, but he's like a 1.5. Which is, with another number one corner on the field, he looks like a number one corner.
Yeah, exactly.
Reminds me a lot of Malcolm. It's a better version of Malcolm Butler, I think. Same thing. Like, Butler could be amazing as long as somebody else was taking the hardest spot. So then we come over to the offense, not really worried about running back. The Patriots always have a platoon. They'll add somebody else to the platoon. And you have no idea who it is because
it won't matter.
It won't matter. Because they'll just bring in somebody who's going to, you know, be the fourth guy. Then he'll become the third and the second. But tight end is my biggest place. I want to see a tight end. I want to see, you know, I don't know. I need to see a fullback because Jakob Johnson has been fantastic. So again, like here's a guy that everybody laughed at when the Patriots signed him because he was the only player in the NFL that didn't count as a roster spot because he was an international development player.
Oh.
So they got an exemption for his spot because it was like, look, we just signed a guy out of Europe. And he's an amazing fullback. Now he consumes a real roster spot. So they're like, no, we want to pay him real money so nobody else signs him away.
It's like an Australian punter or something like that. Like,
yeah, that sort of thing. But he's an amazing fullback. Looks like he's going to grow into the James Devlin role. You know, wide receiver. You know, our wide receiver core is not what it needs to be.
I've got
a huge fan of Edelman, but I think my guess is Edelman's retiring. Or he's going to retire and then, you know, miraculously feel better and be playing in Tampa Bay next year.
I honestly, like, I forget. It was sometime in the middle of the season when I was watching a Pats game and I saw Edelman. I was like, wait a second. I looked at my son. I was like, didn't Edelman retire? He's like, I thought so too. No.
Nope, not yet.
You know, without Tom, you know, throwing him the ball and throwing those little, you know, 5-yard drag routes, you just didn't see his name.
Right, you did. Well, you didn't see his name because, you know, one of the challenges we saw this year was, you know, people have this confusion about what it means for a wide receiver to have separation and be open. It's not like they get open and stay open. It's really about maneuver that they create an opening for like 3/4 of a second. If and that's amazing if they're open for that long. And Edelman specializes in it. Like nobody can keep Edelman covered. But you have to trust in him and throw the ball when he isn't open, and he'll catch it.
You also have to be able to throw the ball.
Yeah, if you're able to throw the ball, but it's more a timing thing. Like Newton didn't have that relationship with him, so would throw the ball when Edelman was open, but then Edelman wasn't open by the time the ball got there. Right. So it, you know, we didn't see a lot, and he was injured a bunch this year. You know, my attitude is Edelman belongs in the Hall of Fame. I don't think he'll get there, but he
I would tend to agree with you, honestly, just because it's one of those things. I think it was Dan Patrick that I heard say this, like, you can't tell the story of the Super Bowl, like the history of the Super Bowl without Julian Edelman.
Right.
Like you just can't, like in the same way you can't tell it without, I'm sorry, Eli Manning.
Right.
You just can't. Like,
well,
he's probably going to go to the Hall of Fame because of two passes, essentially.
Quite possibly. I'm less excited for, but could do that. Like Edelman is also one of the greatest punt returners in NFL history. Like people forget about that. One of the greatest possession receivers. Like I think there was a 4 years where he led the NFL in catches.
Yeah.
And you know, so I want to see something there. Actually, the place I'm looking for is who's going to be their next Matthew Slater. And Matthew Slater is a guy that most people don't know about unless you're a strong football fan. So for those listening, very brief thing on football. Every so often you see a punt in football where one team's like, well, we didn't make our 10 yards, so we're going to kick the ball to you, and you get to try. And when you see the punt formation line up, you see these two guys at the far end edges of the field. Those are the gunners. Their job is to get downfield and tackle. On most teams, it's like this role that you're a cornerback or a wide receiver who isn't quite good enough to make the roster on your own, but you're fast and you can play that route, that role, and you get to do it for a couple of years, and then you make the roster for real, and of course, you're never going to do this again.
Or you get catastrophically injured.
Or you get catastrophically injured. Yeah. Matthew Slater has basically done this job since the day he was drafted, 13 years. He plays, you know, all of the special teams positions. He's nominally a wide receiver. In 13 years, he has caught one pass in the NFL. That's it. But he made a career out of being really good at this important job. And that's all he does. And he went to the Pro Bowl. He's got, I forget how many times, like 7 or 8 times he's voted to the Pro Bowl. I think he's a better special teams player than Steve Tasker, who is the other great special teams player out of the Bills who should be in the Hall of Fame but isn't. I think both of them ought to go.
Steve Tasker was not a big guy.
It was not a big guy. And Slater's not a big guy either. He's a really slender guy, but he is fast. You know, at his age, he's still out running other people, and teams put two or three guys to stop him because that's what it takes to keep him out of a play. And when you're building a team, you need to build the team around people like that, that they can do a role that most people take for granted, that you would just give as an odd job to somebody else. And they will do that job with a level of skill that nobody else demonstrates.
His dad was a good player too.
His dad was Jackie Slater, Hall of Fame for the lineman for the LA Rams. I grew up in LA, so I've gotten to actually root for both Slaters.
Yeah, his dad was tough. He was one of those early players I remember as a kid. I was like, that guy looks terrifying. Like, you know, just standing on the sideline, you're like, you don't want to.
I've met him and he still looks terrifying. Like,
I believe it.
Like most of these guys that get out of the NFL and they like drop a whole bunch of body weight and they drop back to looking like normal people. Like Jackie Slater still looks like a nice guy, but he just still is this massive human being.
And he's got to be 60 plus years old.
But he's really nice, very kind guy. But at the same time, you look at him and you're like, yeah, I don't want to be in his way.
No, I'm going to cross the street. all right. Well, Andy, this was super fun. It's always good to catch up with you, man. And I'm glad that you're staying safe, you're staying healthy. And hopefully we will not do another podcast like this in 9 months where we're talking about the stupid pandemic and the quarantine again.
Hopefully please no. Yeah, I'm hopeful that we will not have another podcast until we're out of the quarantine. But, you know, I always like talking to you. So if we talk again before then, I'm happy. But I'm hoping we can be outdoors and actually see human beings at some point.
That would be great. Yeah. All right, Andy. Thanks so much, man. It was great catching up with you.
Thanks, Dennis. While you were hacking the planet, I was trying to decide for what it meant, even if I could not.